I'm Baby Hugs, and you're listening to The Medley with Blake Prizzle.
Hi everyone, Blake Crash Priddle here, and welcome to The Medley. This week we're going to be speaking with Canadian actress, activist, and writer Terry Hawkes. You'll be hearing her story about how she became an actress, as well as what inspired her to become an activist. She's perhaps best known to Sailor Moon fans as the voice of the title character, but she also did the voices of Shrieky and Baby Hugs Bear in Care Bears. Terry, it's great to have you on The Medley this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Blake, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
What ignited your passion for acting and show business?
My mother, honestly. We lived in an American city, Fort Collins, Colorado, a nice college town, for a couple of years while my dad was pursuing a PhD. And my mother, at the time, didn't have a work permit. So she started looking at opportunities to work in, not to work, but to volunteer in the amateur theater world. So she came home one day and she said, honey, I'm doing this play and they can't find a kid to play the little boy. Would you like to audition? And I said, sure, why not? So I went to this audition. I got the role. I did this very charming play with my mother called The Invisible People about this little kid who had imaginary friends. And it was really fun to do that with my mom. And that led to three other plays in the very theater-friendly town of Fort Collins. It's now a city. And it was a vibrant amateur theater community. And we made friends and we enjoyed thoroughly. And there were wonderful productions of musicals that I was able to be in, like The Sound of Music and South Pacific. And those 2 years were really wonderful years in my life and in my mother's life and my brother's life, while my dad also really enjoyed his studies. But we got very involved in the arts, and that led to me pursuing singing and dancing when we returned to Calgary, and summer programs at the Banff School of Fine Arts, and that eventually led to my first professional acting opportunity. So, and there's more, but that's basically the beginning of it.
What was your first professional acting opportunity?
Oh, okay. Well, I was at the Banff School of Fine Arts, where they had this amazing musical theater program at the time. And the government of Alberta subsidized the students for 6 weeks. It was just incredible, something my family could not have afforded if we hadn't had those scholarships. But anyway, they put on these fabulous musicals with professional directors and set designers and choreographers, and I was in a production of the musical called Carousel, and there was a theater director who happened to be there at the time named Peter Coe, and he was the artistic director of the Citadel Theater in Edmonton, so maybe a three-hour drive from Calgary, but a very well-respected Canadian regional theater company. And he saw my work in a workshop at Banff and then again in Carousel. And he approached me one day outside on the hills in the Rocky Mountains and said, I saw your work in Carousel and I'd like to offer you a job at the Citadel Theatre in Edmonton. I said, well, that's very nice of you. What show are you talking about? He said, well, it's an original musical, and it's about Marilyn Monroe, and I'd like you to play Norma Jean, the young Marilyn. And I said, oh, when would it start? And he said, well, rehearsals start in December. We go up in January. And I was just about to start my fourth year of university. So I said, oh, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity, but I'm in university and I'll have my exams in December and then I'll start another class in January. I'm afraid I can't accept your offer. So he was probably a little surprised because he probably wasn't used to being turned down. But at the same time, I had no idea what an incredible opportunity that was. So when I told my teachers at Banff of this offer, they all said to me, are you kidding me? You have to do this job. This doesn't happen every day. This is a wonderful opportunity. So Thanks to the University of Calgary, I was able to arrange to write my exams early and then take a course remotely for the next term. And I was able to do the show in Edmonton. And it was a truly wonderful experience. I learned a lot. It was challenging. It was rewarding. It was my first professional experience. And the play was called Hey Marilyn by Cliff Jones, brand new musical. And at the end of that experience, I thought to myself, gee, if I'm ever going to pursue this professionally, this might be the time to give it a try. And I hadn't grown up thinking that that's what I would do. I had thought at one point I might go to law school. But I think the Banff School of Fine Arts at the time and Hey Marilyn and the opportunities I had as a young person really fueled my curiosity and my passion for the arts. And Hey Marilyn was sort of a turning point where I made a decision to give this profession a try. And I have to say I've been very, very fortunate to have worked for many years now in this realm. So yeah, that's sort of, those are the beginnings.
When most people think of Alberta, especially Calgary, they think of the country music scene, but they clearly have a very good theater program out there too, and a good theater scene.
You're right, they do. The University of Alberta in Edmonton is quite renowned for its drama department. A lot of the actors that you would know of from Stratford and Shaw and beyond came through that program, so it was very well respected. And as I say, the Banff School of Fine Arts, it's now called the Banff Center, and it has a bit more of a corporate bent in some ways, but it provided these incredible incubators for original work, not just in theater, but in music and dance and many areas of the arts and visual arts as well. It was in its prime, that would be my view of it, in the 70s and 80s. It was one of the foremost destinations for artists in the world. And it was also largely thanks to the Alberta government. They had some funds, and they shared their funds with this arts community. And there are many people that you would know, Blake, when you see them on theater, film, and television, who came through that program. It was really extraordinary. We were very fortunate to be part of it.
We're going to talk about Sailor Moon in a little bit, but another role that you had in the 80s was Care Bears, where you did the voice of Baby Hugs and Shrieky. How did you land those two roles?
So I kind of gave you my childhood and youth history. And I did forget to mention one group in Calgary. I want to plug them. The Young Canadians of the Calgary Stampede. So my gammy, my grandma, upon my return from Fort Collins, suggested I audition for them. And they provide singing and dancing scholarships to young people in Calgary. And in return, the kids perform in this incredible outdoor grandstand show at the Calgary Stampede for 10 nights in a row. So that also, being a scholarship program, gave me opportunities I wouldn't have had otherwise. And they provided incredible training to their students, and they still do. So anyway, there was that. So I had that training in Alberta. And then I decided to move to Toronto, partly for personal reasons, but largely for professional reasons. There wasn't a big film and television community in Alberta at that time. There's more so now. But also, Toronto had a larger population. They had even more theater than Calgary and Edmonton, even though Calgary and Edmonton and some of the smaller towns had vibrant theaters, there was still more opportunity in Toronto. So I decided to give it a try. I really didn't know anybody in the industry. I didn't know how it worked. I've said elsewhere, I basically opened a phone book, first in Alberta and then again in Toronto. And I just started knocking on doors of agencies in Toronto because I was told that that's how you get auditions. I've since learned, and I kind of knew then, that often you get auditions just through your own networking and showing up and knocking on doors. And I did that, and I still do that, I guess, in a sense. But agents are also another really a wonderful member of your team, and they can get you auditions for things that they know of through professional connections that you might not know of, especially as a young actor. So I knocked on doors, and one of the doors I knocked on was a company called, what were they called at the time? Oscars and Abrams. And I met a young agent named Gail Abrams. She was in her 20s. And I like to tell the story. I walked in and she had her feet up on the desk, and she was really had settled into her new role as an agent of actors. And we clicked. And I think I caught her just at a good point in her career. She was kind of starting out and I was starting out, and she was a bit older than me. And so she seemed more worldly and professional, and I worked really hard, and I think she saw that, and she saw that I had had some success already in Alberta, and she took me on, and we had a very good working relationship and friendship, and we worked together for a few decades and had a lot of successes that we shared. So that's a long answer to your question, but one of my first auditions was for Care Bears, and I think that that came out of, actually, in Alberta, I opened the phone book and I phoned a radio producer at CBC named Fred DL in Alberta and just said I wanted to work in radio drama. And I didn't realize that's not usually how you get those jobs. But he called me in for an interview and he gave me a job. And all of a sudden I had a radio drama credit with the CBC under my belt, which I would have shared with Gail Abrams. And then she sort of used that to convince the people, I guess, at Nelvana at the time to see me or hear me for an audition for Care Bears. And in fact, there were probably a couple of shows earlier than Care Bears, like Strawberry Shortcake and Herself the Elf, where I had smaller roles. And I think probably Care Bears was probably the third animated series that I did, to the best of my recollection. It was a while ago now. Yeah, so that's how I came to do Baby Hugs and Shrieky.
How did you develop the voice for those two characters? Because Shrieky sounds like, you know, a spoiled brat kind of character, and then in comparison, Hugs is very cutesy and just so innocent. But how did you develop those two voices?
Well, generally how one develops voices in a professional setting is that there's input from other people as well as you, the actor. So I honestly don't remember the specifics, but what I can tell you is when I work on characters, whether it's in theater, film, television, voiceover work, I generally do a lot of research around the character. And if I don't know a lot about the character from the scripts or from the director or the writers, I develop a story for myself to use as background information and research. So I would write a character biography, and I would add in things that I know or things that I invent, and I would make notes on my relationship with other characters. So for example, as Baby Hugs, I always thought I had a very close relationship with Baby Tugs, and that I would hope that there'd be a real chemistry there, a real caring, but a kind of a playfulness between the two of them. And I think Melanie, Baby Tugs, and I did find that. Hopefully we found that. And I thought of Baby Hugs as just this embodiment of love, which partly comes from Baby Hugs' name. So compassion. I think of Hugs as compassionate, empathetic, loving, and obviously childlike, and perhaps a bit naive, and perhaps a bit idealistic. So that's sort of the beginning of the character development, and then the voice sort of evolves from there, and sort of the youth of that voice was important to me, and the lightness. And I think when I think of Baby Hugs, I think of clouds and love and hearts and just those kind of airy, ideal, happy qualities. And so that, and I'm sure I had input from the casting director and then the director. And so what generally happens is you maybe try a few different voices for them, or they might ask you to make a slight adjustment. little higher pitch, a little lower pitch, maybe a slightly different attitude, and then you all kind of collectively settle on, oh yeah, that sounds like the voice that we all think is Baby Hugs. And I would say Shrieky would have done the same kind of thing, but obviously a very different character and the antagonist. And I would agree with you that she was a bit entitled and spoiled and, you know, came across as being very self-confident. I want to rule the world. But I always think that with characters like that, and perhaps human beings in real life, when they come across as being strident and controlling and bullying, usually that masks a deep insecurity and a lack of confidence and a lack of being settled and happy. And so it's an animated series, and it's mostly for kids, and we don't want to get too heavy and dark, but certainly when I do my character work, I try to look for those nuances and the colors within the character and maybe the reasons that they might act a certain way. And the one line, and I haven't warmed up or anything, but the one line that always comes to mind when I think of Shrieky is, I want to rule the world.
That's actually very impressive. The line that comes to mind when I think of Shrieky is always calling poor Beastly a furball. There's one episode where Shrieky showed a different side of herself, where she appeared to be in love with Songfellow Strum, a musician on Care Bears, which seemed to contradict her love of hate, so to speak.
Okay, well, I appreciate you sharing that with me, because I don't remember that really well. So, yeah, it's always nice when the writers, illuminate a different side of a character, especially with the villains or the antagonists, because they can be very stereotypical and kind of one-dimensional, so I always look for those different colors, and it's really nice when you receive that in the script, right?
As time went on, you got the role of Serena in Sailor Moon, which is without a doubt an iconic role of an iconic TV show. How did it feel to work on Sailor Moon, not only doing the voice of Serena, but working as a voice director? Because I hear that you were also a voice director on that show, too.
Yeah, not a primary voice director, but there were times when the primary director, the original one, Roland Parliament, wasn't available for some reason. He had a conflict, and Nicole Twell, the producer, asked me to fill in. And that was great, because it was great training and a great opportunity, and led to other voice directing gigs for me. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoy working with actors in that respect. I loved it. It was great. And you referred to them as iconic characters, and I would agree with you. And I would say, but at the time we were recording them, we didn't think of them as iconic. And it's such a great cast, that original cast, that we had really, really well-respected and talented actors. And Katie Griffin, and Joe Frappier, Susan Roman, Karen Bernstein, Toby Proctor, Stephanie Morgenstern, Ron Rubin. It was just such a great group of actors. And we gelled when we recorded together, and we weren't always recording together, but it was a very solid and professional company. So that in and of itself is such a pleasure, to work with such professionals. And joyful, really a joyful experience for sure. But we didn't know that it was so groundbreaking. And that came later. And it was, I think, a surprise to us. But as the years have gone on, I think to myself, well, maybe it shouldn't have been such a surprise. It was sort of the front runner, well, in the anime world that I wasn't familiar with. But just in terms of the story, I think it was very progressive in some ways. And one of the ways that I think is most obvious is that it was about girl superheroines. So gender played a role in that. All of a sudden, the kinds of roles where we mostly saw boys and men fulfill, like heroes, all of a sudden there were girls who were able to be powerful and able to have agency and able to save the world from the Negaverse. And that was relatively new, I think. So, and they didn't do it alone. They did it with the support of their friends, the Sailor Scouts, so that it was about community and collective action and that kind of thing too. So I think, and more, you know, there was the implication of a same-sex relationship, and I've heard from many people over the years now that the social messages that Sailor Moon often said at the end of the shows and some of the storylines were very empowering to people when they were dealing with certain challenges in their lives. So I think in some ways, in fact, I've been told by many people that it really helped them overcome some mental health challenges and some difficulties in their lives, finding the courage to come out as a member of the LGBTQ plus community. I've heard that many times. And so I think it really pushed the envelope. And the North American version was slightly different from the Japanese version after the translation. And I think some of that was lost in translation, and there were some other things that maybe were gained in translation. So like Serena and Sailor Moon, the show is imperfect in my view, but I think that the pros really outweighed the cons, and that's why it has assumed this iconic status in the world of anime and beyond.
Well, a good friend of mine used to watch it all the time, and she recently introduced Sailor Moon to her daughter, and she loves it, and she even named her pet cat after one of the cats on Sailor Moon, Luna, to be exact.
That's sweet.
But one of the things that I liked about Sailor Moon when I was a kid was the Sailor Says segments, where she would give the viewers some good messages and some good advice on how to deal with certain situations that you might encounter in your life, such as what to do if somebody gets hurt, or what to do if you see somebody who's being bullied, that sort of thing.
Yes, for sure. I think those were beautiful messages. So, and I don't take credit for that. That was Naoko Takeuchi and the writing team. And yes, I do think that was a bit unique. And because there were so many young people who were watching this show, those are the kinds of stories I've heard, like, gee, I was being bullied at school, but I would watch Sailor Moon before school or after school or at lunchtime, and it would teach me some ways to deal with that. Or, you know, I was having a tough time with one of my parents, and I got some good ideas from Sailor Moon or Serena, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I agree. I'm glad that that was meaningful to you, and I've heard similar stories, and that makes me feel good. That if the show could be helpful to some people, what could be better, honestly?
You've written a screenplay for a film called The Book of Eve. How did that project come to be? And for listeners that aren't familiar with the film, what's it about?
That was a wonderful experience, too. So The Book of Eve, as a feature film, was adapted from the novel by Constance Beresford Howe called The Book of Eve. And I was commissioned to adapt it to a screenplay. And at the time, I was just finishing a master's in fine arts in playwriting from UCLA in Los Angeles. And I had stayed at UCLA for an extra year to take all the screenwriting and producing directing courses that I could. It was just such a wonderful incubator for emerging filmmakers, writers, playwrights, and we had access to a lot of people in the profession, partly because we were in LA. So anyway, I was working very hard on writing plays and screenplays, and I was at a social event, and I met a producer, Marie-José Raymond from Quebec, and her husband, Claude Fournier, who was a director, and they had a company called Rose Films. And they hired me to adapt this novel. And I was in my 30s. But the story was about a woman in her 60s, actually. I think she just turned 65 in the novel and in the screenplay. And took the opportunity when she started receiving her social assistance as a senior, took the opportunity to leave a very toxic marriage in which she was very financially comfortable, but emotionally, I would say, abused. And the story follows her leaving this very tony, elite area of Montreal and creating a new and independent life for herself in a sketchy area of Montreal and with very limited resources. So she basically left a very comfortable life in order to be independent and to pursue a healthier life for herself. And her adult son really resisted, her husband really resisted her choices, but she proved that she could survive in some kind of clever and unique ways. And she didn't ever follow a path that one might expect or that was traditional, but by the end of the story in the novel and in the film, she had created a new life for herself with joy and new friendships and support systems from neighbors and pursuing a way of earning income that I won't give away if anybody sees the film, that was unique and kind of a creative choice. So it was really, I like to think of it as a coming of age story of a woman who was 65. I don't really often see coming of age stories of people at that age, but I loved that she was an older woman and the central character, beautifully played by Claire Bloom. And we didn't see that many stories of central characters who are women who are that age. And we still don't see a lot. We do see a few more today, but it's one of the reasons that I continue to write stories that are often very female-centric and about middle-aged women or older, and I try to give voice to them because I do think that age group is an underrepresented group still. And so I like to participate in the telling of stories of different underrepresented groups. And that was a beginning of an awareness for me that those stories are important and need to be told.
Your IMDb profile says that you're an activist, where according to the profile, you are an activist where you do work to support women and youth in the arts. What else do you have to do to achieve those goals?
Oh my gosh. I don't have any grand master plan, but certain opportunities have emerged in my life where there seemed like an opportunity to support others or make someone's journey a little easier. And if I've been able to, I've grabbed those opportunities because they feel good, frankly. And I think partly that's what life is about, is making a difference for your community, for your friends, for your neighbors, for people you don't even know. But if you can help, if you can step up, I think that's partly what the meaning of life is. So what have I done? So yes, so with youth in the arts, it came to me through some volunteer work I was doing at one of my kids' schools. And we were working with a sister school. It was in an under-resourced area of Toronto. And my kids, around the same time, were having a very special celebration for a journey in their life. And they were given a number of very generous gifts. And they put aside a good portion of those gifts to create a fund to support other middle school kids in accessing the arts, kids from an under-resourced area. And so we still are connected to that group. It's been over a decade now. And I have taught writing to lots of kids in elementary and middle school through this program. And we've supported kids who are interested in other areas of the arts in accessing different teachers, different programs throughout the city of Toronto. And it's just a joy to see some of these kids blossom and develop. And there are a few who are in university now, and we're still in touch. And they may or may not pursue the arts professionally, but they say that it's had an impact on their lives, and that's fantastic. So that's one thing. I get involved in political campaigns, supporting candidates who I believe in and who I believe will make a positive difference in our communities. Recently, I've been involved in a grassroots activist campaign questioning a particular development in Toronto that doesn't seem to serve the needs of the residents And so it goes. So when those opportunities arise, I look for community and people who are interested in doing the work with me. And we tend to find each other. And I hope that continues. It's something that really fills me up.
Yes, your father, Jim Hawks, was an MP in Calgary a long time ago. Did he inspire you to become an activist as well, or did he inspire any of your work?
Wow, you've done your research, Blake. That's pretty great. Yeah, my dad was a very influential person in my life. He's passed away now. He was a research psychologist, and that led him to doing a number of research projects for the Canadian government around employment, Indigenous affairs, many other areas. And he was someone who really wanted to make a difference, both for his friends. He was the kind of friend who was always there to listen and support, for his colleagues in the world of academia. And then later, with these research projects, it led him to a new community of people who were in office, provincially, federally. And he loved supporting people he believed in, which led him to be, he supported Joe Clark in his leadership campaign for the Progressive Conservative Party. And that led to an offer to my father to be the policy coordinator for the Progressive Conservative Party at that time. And policy was of interest to him because he thought that could really make a difference in people's lives. So he embraced that, and that led to him running for parliament. And he was a member of parliament for 14 years, and he served the constituents of Calgary West fully and completely, often to his own detriment health-wise. And he also had a true partner in my mother, who, as his partner in life, but also as an engaged spouse of a member of parliament, who created support systems for other spouses and members of parliament, and participated in my father's service to the residents. And all this to say that both of my parents, my mother Joanne Hawks and my dad Jim Hawks, and their extended families have always been of service in some way to their community. My dad started with the YMCA when he was young, and he taught basketball and swimming. My mother played piano for gymnastics classes at the Y. That's where they met. But being of service and welcoming people into our homes, if they were having into our home, or I guess more than one home over the years, welcoming people who were having a rough time and supporting people through difficult times was just something I witnessed around me with my parents. So yeah, I would say that that was inspiring and helped me forge some of the values that I have today and the values that I share with my own children.
As Graham's Bear would say, this reminds me of a story. I went to the Calgary Stampede in 2012, and I really got to see the theater scene that Calgary has to offer, because there were all kinds of really cool performances put on by talented people. So you were certainly right about the theater scene that Calgary has to offer, and all of Alberta for that matter.
Oh, I'm so glad that you had that experience.
Same here. But what's the biggest piece of advice that you can give to up-and-coming talent that may be struggling right now?
Wow, that's a big question, because it's not just the arts where people are struggling. The economy has made it really tough for young people and emerging artists, and in other fields as well. I guess so. What I would say to artists, what I have said for years, hasn't changed a lot, which is that the arts is a precarious field. Most people who work in the arts do not make a living in the arts. I've been very, very fortunate to make a living for many of the years that I've worked in the arts, but that's not usual. So I would try to give people a bit of a reality check and say, if you're looking for financial stability, and if there's something else in your life that you're passionate about that might lead you to that, you might want to consider that and consider keeping the arts as a hobby or something that you do in your spare time, the way I did community theater earlier on. At the same time, if you are passionate about your art form and can't imagine doing anything else, I would say then go for it and give it your best shot and reach out to others in your community for help, build your networks, take as many classes as you can, perfect your craft to the best of your ability, continue to learn and take classes for years and years to come, and create your own opportunities. So I think one of the mistakes artists can make with agents, who I mentioned earlier and so on, is to depend on the agents or other people to provide the opportunities for them. Whereas my experience is I have had to create a lot of those opportunities myself. And so then it becomes a bit of a collective effort with your representatives as well as your own elbow grease, as it were. So, that's kind of been my standard. I try not to give advice, but that's my personal experience that I share. So take it or leave it. And I admire anyone who pursues what they're passionate about to their full ability. That in itself is pretty impressive.
What does the future hold for you? Do you have any other projects that you're working on or any other goals for the near future?
Yeah, I'm focusing on writing for television at the moment. I'm working on a couple of new scripts that I would love to see produced that are dramedies and fun and hopefully would make people laugh. But like pretty much everything I write, they have a social undercurrent. They examine some questions in our society, and hopefully the audience would watch one of these shows and go away thinking about their choices in life and how they might make a difference, that kind of thing. So that's kind of the tone of most things I write. I want people to be entertained, and I want them to have the opportunity to learn something and to maybe think about things in a light that they haven't thought of them in before. So yeah, I'm putting a lot of energy into that right now. There's also a web series that I acted in recently called Lady Ada's Secret Society. So that's on camera acting, created by a friend and a really talented collaborator, Shannon Fuster. And it's on Marble Kids YouTube, and it's received a lot of accolades. Lots of awards have come out of this show: ensemble awards, acting awards, directing awards, writing awards. And it's got what I just described. It's about a girls' school where the girls are dissuaded from studying math, science, technology, all the STEM subjects, and yet they love it. They have a passion for science and math, etc., and they form this underground society, Lady Ada's Secret Society, in their school, and they use their science acumen to play pranks on the rest of the student body, and they have a headmistress who thwarts them at every turn, and that would be me. So once again, an antagonist, very fun role. It's really a sweet, fun, funny series with the social messaging that we need more girls in STEM subjects. We need more women in the sciences. So hopefully that's a message that young people can pick up when they watch this series. And we're hopeful that that will lead to a season two. Pretty close to that, so stay tuned for Lady Ada's Secret Society.
Well, I know that working on TV shows takes a lot of work, so your time is greatly appreciated, and thank you so very much for joining us again.
Blake, it is a pleasure. You did your research, your questions are awesome, and I really thank you for including me. Thanks so much.
And that was actress, writer, and activist Terry Hawks. I hope that you enjoyed this week's interview, and remember, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.